Welcome to another special episode of Oncology on the Go, hosted by Daniel C. McFarland. In this episode, Dr. McFarland sat down with Boris Kisilev to discuss depression in cancer care. The pair touched on a differential diagnosis, key treatment modalities, medication options, and the importance of holistic approaches.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm very pleased today. I have Dr. Kisilev with me. He's returned to discuss actually the treatment of depression or depressive symptoms in patients with cancer. We had a podcast earlier this year talking about the diagnosis of depression in patients with cancer. And so we kind of established that making the diagnosis requires some thoughtful assessment of the key symptoms, you know, alongside the patient's exact situation, sort of their baseline personality and functionality. Essentially, you try to get this longitudinal picture of the symptoms and sort of see where the cancer is kind of coming in, and then you're sort of making a judgment about these symptoms and should they be addressed or not. This is a really key distinction and something we all kind of confront at some point. Let's suppose that we are concerned for the presentation and the depressive symptoms that the patient is kind of presenting with. And now you want to start to address the depressive symptoms. So what should we really be considering in this moment? How do we begin treatment while, you know, kind of thinking about the resources that we have available? What are the reasonable skills for oncologists to master in this regard, you know, versus mental health specialists? Another question might be, you know, what kind of treatment is reasonable for me to start? And should I be thinking about medication? So my hope is that the listener can take away kind of a general framework of depression treatment in the cancer setting. Let's say that we have that hypothetical patient in front of us that has presented with what looks like some depressive symptoms. And I want to ask, first of all, Dr. Kisilev, before starting any depression treatment modality, how might we think about a differential diagnosis? What are the key kind of rule out diagnoses that we should consider?
For sure. I mean, just like with any area of medicine, we always want to start with the differential and make sure that we think through that and then target our treatment at the diagnosis that we're like feeling most certain about. Certainly, there can be some overlap. Certainly, we can have a broad differential and not be, there may be multiple things sort of going on, but we want to at least think through. The biggest ones to kind of think about, one would be, first of all, delirium. We definitely want to really convince ourselves there's not delirium present. Because if there is a delirium present, the treatment for that is you know, much different. And adding a medication may worsen delirium. So we really want to be really convince ourselves there's not delirium present, in particular in the inpatient setting. So if you're seeing someone inpatient and they're having, you know, low mood, the most common cause of that in a psycho-oncology population really probably would be delirium rather than depression. So we really, really want to triple check that. That'd be tests of sustained attention, you know, not just orientation questions, but world backwards, test of sustained attention, you know, month of the year backwards, three-word recall, so on and so forth. Really convince yourself there's no delirium.
Boris, I just want to stop you right there for a sec, because this is such an important point. And you hit it a bit. The question is, how do you rule out delirium? How do you make sure? And the thing is, obviously, depression has some cognitive issues. People sort of feel that, like, their brain's not working as well as it should be. How do you distinguish that from delirium?
So their cognitive symptoms are very, very part of the symptoms of depression. The idea is that in delirium, we're looking at a disorder of sensorium. So arousal and attention, that's the two main components of delirium. There's a person very sleepy, very tired, alternating perhaps with areas of increased arousal, right? And then the attention, right? And that's their ability to sustain attention on one thing, which again, you know, folks with delirium may have difficulty focusing, but they should have some basic ability to maintain attention. And for that, we do these kind of what we call tests of sustained attention. That might look like, and usually these are basically tests that just involve our working memory and force us to use our working memory and attend to one thing. So a common one might, for instance, might be spelling the word world backwards, because you have to remember what was the last word and you have to go backwards. Another one might be the months of the year backwards, just naming those. Serial sevens, right? Counting backwards from 100 by seven, and then so on and so forth, right? Or memorization, like let's give you 3, 4, 5 words and then ask those same words again, because they have to keep attending to the task. Mm-hmm. So anything that's using that sustained attention is usually a pretty good test for detecting. And delirium, you know, certainly waxes and wanes. It can mimic lots of things. If a person's pretty oriented and they're able to do those tests of sustained attention, and we feel comfortable they don't have delirium, then I think we're okay to kind of move on to the next step. And in certainly, though delirium is more common in an outpatient population, it still can be what's going on. So doing those kind of tests is extremely, and again, they're all pretty brief, they're all pretty short.
It's a really good point too, because we often see patients that say they were hospitalized and they were delirious in the hospital. There is an association. You know, I see patients that will develop a depression after a delirium. That hospital course and having had delirium is also, in my mind, it's very important for also thinking about depression. But, you know, you're kind of getting at that the attention is key with delirium, that, you know, you'll see someone try and then they kind of falter and they kind of, it's like strange to them. Like, why am I not able to think this through? Right. And so that's the sensorium part that you're talking about, or just trailing off, you know, not paying attention. Whereas depression, it's generally more of like an apathy, you know, that they're just not giving the effort. But it is such an important point, because Boris knows we get a lot of patients. We think this patient is depressed, but they're really delirious. And so that's a constant thing in our field, right?
Absolutely. Super common. Actually, I think one center, they did a study on this and looked at consults to the inpatient psychiatry service for depression. Something like 40% of those consults, the patient was actually delirious. So 100%. It's a very, and again, it can be subtle. It's not always so easy to tell. So, but I think just keeping it in a background for us to kind of just triple checking that, not crossing off that box, feeling comfortable that's not going on. Like, that's mm-hmm. a good one for sure.
Other rule outs you would say are big?
Other kind of couple big ones. The next one would be bipolar disorder, right? So that will be, you know, making sure it's not in their chart. That could also be, if you're not sure, it's okay to ask a screening question, any history of mania type symptoms. You can give symptoms like, you know, a bunch of days in a row, we didn't have any sleep, felt lots of energy, that sort of thing. So that would be another quick one to rule out. Certainly if someone has a documented history of like depression listed in their chart, they've been on antidepressants before, there's not any listed history of bipolar disorder, we can feel pretty comfortable that's not likely going on. But it's a helpful one to just check off, because if you're prescribing antidepressants, those can trigger mania, mixed states, or not work in patients with bipolar disorder. So that's another one we kind of just wanted to rule out.
Particularly in younger patients, if I always think like a manic episode's generally not subtle. I'll even say a manic episode, you know, they they might tell you what they think that is, and then it's kind of up to you to decide. But if then someone's having an episode of mania, it generally gets them in trouble with some kind of issue. But for the younger patients in particular.
Sure. Because they may not have revealed themselves yet. Right. Older patient, you know, we will know or not, you know, because this is typically an illness that develops kind of in that adolescence, early adulthood type period, you know, 20s, 30s, that sort of thing, for sure.
Okay. Any other big ones you would think of?
The other kind of two other big ones. One would be, I'd say, medical conditions that could be mimicking or causing depression symptoms. Mm. So the big ones there, it would be especially like endocrinopathies, in particular, you know, adrenal insufficiency, hypothyroidism, and especially in patients with receiving immunotherapy where the risk of endocrinopathies is so high. And I've definitely had several patients like this where we're consulted for depression, but then we kind of and in fact, with immunotherapy, the endocrinopathy may develop, you know, sometime later. So, and now they've developed it, and when that gets treated, their depressive symptoms resolve. Because the idea is we're trying to target our treatment to the underlying cause. Also, any other major medical condition that could be, again, mimicking. So a severe anemia, you know, a advanced organ failure where the person is, you know, really dyspneic because of advanced heart failure, and that's why they can't do anything. So making sure there's not those things going on. This is where it can get complicated. Someone can have COPD that's really bad and also be depressed, but it's helpful to clarify what the symptoms bothering the person and making sure it's not another medical condition that we need to address, because an antidepressant or therapy is not going to address those conditions.
Right.
The last one I put out there too, as far as just to kind of think through, would be, as far as like, we don't want to miss it, would be a neurocognitive issue. Like, so this could be related to a primary CNS malignancy or metastatic disease to the brain where we have involvement of the brain, especially the frontal lobe, and that's causing a frontal lobe syndrome with apathy. Or it could be, you know, just someone that's developed a dementia picture, whether that be, you know, Alzheimer's or vascular or other, whether or not related to chemotherapy or other treatment or not. But the idea of it, that, you know, this is where it can get complicated, is that the symptoms of neurocognitive disorder may include things like being apathetic, not functioning well, maybe having issues with, you know, focus and so on. But those symptoms may not respond to antidepressant. However, as well, the incidence of depression is much, much, much higher in folks with dementia too. And so that's one where we don't necessarily means we don't give them a treatment for dementia, but depression, but it does mean we really should be thinking about that ahead of time, because that is going to affect our sense of our expectation of what the treatment may do. Because the treatment may help perhaps some irritability or anxiety or some other symptom the person is having related to some depressive component, but it won't resolve perhaps all the symptoms.
Yeah.
In this case, again, if we're not sure, neuropsychological testing can be a helpful additional thing to add.
Good. I think that's great. I think that's a pretty thorough list. I mean, obviously, you know, it's not extensive, but those are the main things. And then, you know, we don't want to scare our oncologists off too much, you know, with too broad of a differential here, but just the general things. So when would it be reasonable for the oncologist to initiate some form of depression treatment versus a mental health referral without really direct involvement? How would you answer that?
I mean, I think, again, a lot of this depends on the person's location, their own comfort, but my hope and dream would be that many oncologists do have some level of comfort to be able to institute some initial treatment, just because of one, the commonness, how common depression is in oncology, and two, that we know the mortality impact it has, right? So we know this is a comorbid condition that both is going to be extremely common in the oncology population and also is going to affect their outcomes. So we want to give the tools to be able to manage it in the hands of the people that are often managing these oncological conditions. So that's kind of my hope. And that's why I'm just super excited to be talking to her today, because I do think that you know, there's oncology is so incredibly complicated. The small steps of just adding a medicine for depression or just doing some basic things there is really, I think, well within the skill set, I think, of many oncologists, I'd say, for sure. And sometimes it just takes getting started with it, doing a couple cases, just trying it out to say, oh, okay, this is actually going all right. And so it's sometimes that, and these are also, again, things that were, you know, if we back in internal medicine, you know, certainly that's something that from residency training is very common comorbidity and so on. That's most cases. There are certain red flags, you know, to think about, right? So those would be cases where we really may want to include a mental health professional. And so I will at least mention those red flags that, like, okay, if it's one of these, I may want to enlist some additional assistance. The big ones there are going to be one is certainly suicidality. If someone has, you know, active suicidal intent or plan, that would be, you know, we're thinking about inpatient treatment at that point. And certainly if someone's high risk, suicide risk, lots of suicide attempts, we probably want to be involving a bigger team, additional support around that person, because their risk level is now already so high in cancer, you know, increases your suicide risk further. We really want to be kind of thinking about that. Anybody with psychotic symptoms, you know, we definitely want to be involving, I'd say, mental health professional there too, because that could represent depression, which can cause psychotic symptoms. It could relate to many other things as well. But that, again, that degree of symptoms and functional impairment, often we need, it's usually helpful to have additional support. If there is a bipolar disorder spectrum condition, I would also recommend mental health involvement at that point too, just because there's a lot of nuance there that in certain medications can worsen that condition, and it'd be helpful to have that assistance. And I guess maybe the last one I put out there too would be, or last two maybe I put out would be severe substance use problems, because those often may not respond to classical depression treatment if something is not done to address the substance use. And then last thing I'll put up there is if someone was just a very complex psychiatric history, if you're seeing this person's had many, many hospitalizations and they have clearly a complex history, that's also someone that it'd be helpful to involve. Maybe I'll put an analogy out there against thinking about, like, say blood pressure, you know, like, you know, oncologists very comfortable managing blood pressure, but if someone, you know, has extremely resistant high blood pressure and is on five different agents and has an EF of 15%, okay, then now we were involving the cardio-oncologist to assist, right? So it's sort of a similar condition, a very common condition, but one that, you know, if it's very bad or has a very high mortality, you know, that person has a very complex history, that's when it makes sense to loop in those additional supports.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's good. One more question, then we're going to kind of get to the treatment part, but I, you know, just conceptually, I just want to hit, do we do we think of depression as distinct categories, or we talked before about depressive symptoms versus depressive diagnosis, but and you know, it's a sort of a large umbrella term, but how do you see the categories of depression?
So in general, we do categorize the depression kind of along a continuum of severity. And that ranges from mild, moderate, moderately severe to severe. So basically it's four buckets. And the easiest way to think about this is just the PHQ-9, which is the very common depression scale that is kind of the most commonly used one that just goes through the 9 symptoms of depression and rates them 0 to 3 in the past 2 weeks. That ranges from 0 to 27. The idea being 0 to 5 is normal. So we know 0 to 4 or 0 to 5, we're not expecting everyone to score 0 on the PHQ-9. Some of those symptoms are things we're going to experience over the course of our life. 5 to 9 is in that we call mild category. 10 to 14 is moderate. 15 to 19 is moderately severe, and above 20 is severe. So that's kind of just a very basic way of like, okay, where's their PHQ-9? That gives you a sense of their symptoms. Certainly in oncology, that, you know, there's a bit of nuance there, and things like appetite, things like sleep, things like concentration, which are on the PHQ-9, may not be related to their depression and maybe be related to the cancer treatment. But, you know, just sort of simplified, that's kind of how we kind of grade it generally, mild to severe.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think that's a helpful distinction, you know, kind of mild, moderate, severe, along the lines of like, what are their symptoms? What's their functional impairment, if any? And it kind of helps direct somewhat the approach to depressive symptoms. So speaking about buckets, what are the treatment options for depression? You know, what are the treatment modalities? How would you do an overview of that?
I typically lump it into 3 main buckets, right? The those 3 buckets being, one, like lifestyle modifications. These are things the person can do in changing their lifestyle that can help, which we have good evidence for, things like exercise, for instance, as being, you know, quite helpful for depression. So these are sort of lifestyle changes the person themselves can make or work towards. Next one I put would be like a psychological intervention. So that would be all of the different types of psychotherapies, of which there are many in the cancer setting. There are a number of these that have been studied and have been shown to have evidence. That includes things like CBT, behavioral activation, mindfulness-based stress reduction, interpersonal therapy. But even if they're not doing one of these, one studied for cancer, like they're doing psychodynamic therapy or some other therapy, it can still help, right? So lifestyle treatments, psychotherapy, psychological interventions. Again, the idea with these, though, is they are administered by a trained professional. So these, you know, this is going to be a therapist or a psychologist, social worker, someone with training in therapy. And then the last bucket, I would say, again, just general basic, would be pharmacotherapy. So these would be medications that we're using to treat depression. Outside of 3 buckets, there's lots of other kind of stuff. There's brain stimulation approaches and so on. But I'll just focus in onto these 3 because those are the 3 most readily accessible ones. People are pretty familiar with those. And those give a good framework to talk to the patient about what they may be most open to. Because not everybody's open to all 3 of those. They may have a preference. And it's often better to target the treatment to what the patient feels most comfortable or interested in doing, because their consistency with that is much likely to be better.
You know, I'm so glad you raised that point, because I was thinking about this earlier today about how, you know, it is important to kind of tailor the treatment to the patient's preferences. At the same time, we encounter a lot of patients. On the one hand, a patient just might want to take a medication. They might sort of say that's going to work for me. On the other side, many patients will say, I do not want a medication. And it turns out a lot of those patients would probably be most benefited by medication. And so you sort of struggle with this. And so I think there's definitely a way to kind of talk through it. There's an educational part of it. We know, because when we start patients on medication, let's say, that, you know, if the patient's reluctant in the first place, it can be really challenging. You know, they're not necessarily going to stick with it. They don't take it all the time. This tends to be folks who really would actually benefit from it. While I agree, you know, with patient-centered approach, of course, I think there's a limitation, and we have to be kind of aware of that. And if we're really going to address this seriously, you know, we need to follow up, ask about it, actually provide sort of moral support in doing this. You know, when you're kind of handing someone a medication, it's sort of like, you know, kind of fix yourself, right? And so it has a lot of implications that are, you know, that can create a lot of divisions. You sort of want to be aware of that messaging and do it in a very caring way. Anyway, I just kind of wanted to make that point because we see it all the time, right?
It's always a working towards that. And again, we have these three kind of buckets. Often my goal for folks is that we're using all three often because each bucket only does so much. And then the more we can add on, the more ways we can tackle this problem, the better people tend to do. So people often will have a preference. And so I think our job is often talking to them about that, clarifying what their concerns are about X or Y or Z. And another thing that I often find helpful is offering, again, if, for instance, we think a therapy would be really helpful, something in any way we can offer options is going to be helpful. So it's sort of offering options that are all okay with you. So for instance, like, let's say the medicine side of things, when I'm first seeing a patient, I may offer more than one different medicine choice. And I might say, hey, here's a choice A, here's a choice B. And the patient having a sense of, hey, I can pick one of these, first of all, gives them some sense of ownership, but also I'm kind of steering them in a way of, these are both things that I think would help. And sometimes it's like, you know, so that can help. But I agree that it's one of those things too, that we often can't push someone very far as well. So sometimes it is sort of meeting them where they're at and just having those conversations. And sometimes also it's a contingency plan, you know, sort of, okay, well, let's try this, you know, so you're okay with starting with therapy. Let's see how that goes. Hearing a lot of symptoms, but I, you know, definitely want to follow up. It sounds like it's a lot. Let's circle back. And like you said, let's follow up. Is that plan of what we're doing, is it working? Is it, if it's not, maybe that does mean we should consider these additional things, you know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's just the trust, you know? And I think that's one of the nice things about oncologists is that as a patient's oncologist, they often will take the treatments that are given by the oncologist because they have that relationship and that alliance with them. And if an oncologist says, hey, this is just super important for your cancer outcomes, I think that carries a lot of weight with patients.
It carries a huge amount of weight. And it also can be done in a way that's truly caring. Mm-hmm. This is a life-changing experience. You're basically kind of saying, look, you know, I want the best for you. Mm-hmm. Let's think about how we can get there. Medication's a tool. It's one of the many tools that we have. And it's tough. You know, the goal is to go back and live your life as normally as possible. And, you know, this is a tool to kind of help get there. We'll talk a little bit later about how to start the medication and all that, because I think that's a really key time. But first, I want to ask, who should receive the non-pharmacologic modalities versus the pharmacologic modalities? Like, how do we decide that?
Certainly patient preference weighs into that. And if they have a strong preference, that may be where we start. The other kind of way to think about it is, again, separating back into that mild, moderate, severe. Let's say gold or NYHA, it's any of these sort of severity classifications. The farther you are along the severity kind of trajectory, the more likely you maybe want to be thinking about a medicine. The idea being that if someone has extremely severe symptoms, it may be difficult for them to engage in a therapy or a lifestyle change because the depression symptoms themselves at that point are so severe that they're likely causing a lot of functional impairment. So if we're having a lot of functional impairment, a lot of symptoms, we often will, you know, lean towards, you know, really considering a medication. Other times they consider medicine would be, again, if someone's obviously not interested in therapy or there's just not access to that where you're located. There is a shortage of mental health clinicians. There just may not be somebody that you can readily refer a patient to, in which case you may be left with less options. So those are kind of, and certainly milder symptoms, less functionally impairing, you know, maybe leaning more towards a therapy. And again, so there's a lot of overlap between what we classify as major depressive disorder and maybe more of an adjustment disorder or a grief or those sort of thing. If we're more in that adjustment disorder realm where the symptoms are more mild and more definitely temporally related, and we may be thinking more about a therapy. And also what I put out too is if the patient has had previous medications and they've done really well with them, that might be a good opportunity to think about that again. Like that's worked for you before. Similarly, if they've done extremely well with therapy before and they have a therapist, again, that's super reasonable as well. So those would be the kind of main thing considerations of what's worked before, how severe is it, you know, how functionally impairing is it?
Yeah. And that last point I think is key. It's sort of like, what's at risk? And I always ask about that, you know, how are your relationships doing? How are you doing at work? And that would also push me to start a medication too, if they're telling me, yeah, those things are kind of struggling, because those are the sort of psychosocial supports that we all need. Let's say that, you know, we're at the point of actually saying, all right, well, there's some depressive symptoms here. I want to start a medication. So then how do we go about that? How do we think about which one, right? That's the big question.
100%, 100%. Basically, when we're targeted, we think about these medicines, we're thinking primarily about what the patient's symptoms are and basically what are we targeting? And we're also thinking through what is the side effects of the medicine itself. You know, that's kind of two main kind of things we're considering. And so that, again, the idea being the depression can be very different for different people. Some people with depression, they sleep more than usual. They feel very tired. They're eating less, right? They may benefit from medicine that increases sleep and increases appetite. Whereas someone else with depression is the opposite. Let's say they're not sleeping at all and so on. So it's like, it's finding that medicine that targets those symptom combinations and also what side effects does the patient absolutely not want. Some people do not want weight gain, right? Some people very much need to gain weight, right? Some people have a ton of anxiety. Some people just feel apathetic and flat all the time. So what is the symptoms and what are the side effects we want to avoid? In general, we have a lot of learners that rotate through our clinic, and whenever I'm talking to learners about medication, there's so many different antidepressants out there. There's no need to memorize all of them. I think just getting comfortable with like maybe three or four at most will get 99% of the what you need, you know. So I would pick, and the way I think about it, I pick one from most of the kind of big classes. So like one SSRI, one SNRI, you know, and maybe mirtazapine, and then maybe bupropion. That'd be four medicines. Very easy to kind of remember those four. They all work differently. They all have different benefits. They have different side effects. So if you have those four tools in the toolbox, most situations you'd be able to sort of like have something to kind of go through with. I guess one question is, would it be helpful for me to go through those four medicines real quick and just talk about them, I guess?
That's interesting. As you were saying that, I was like, yeah, that's kind of how I do blood pressure management at this point, is I have one for each class and that's what I'll start. And so I think that's great advice. You sort of have your like middle of the road, you know, kind of medicine you might start, or one that might help with sleep, one that might help with energy. Before we do that, though, let me say, how might you prepare a patient to start the medication? Because I kind of alluded to like, hey, it's sort of a big deal. I wouldn't do this like kind of off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it just requires some attention. So, you can read my mind, Boris. Like, what attention am I really thinking about? Like, how, as an oncologist, should we be mindful about, we're going to start an antidepressant? What's your recommendation?
The first step there is really acknowledging what the person is experiencing and acknowledging, hey, like, I'm hearing these are the things you're experiencing. And this is a lot. And recognizing as well that they're going through a lot. So recognize there's a lot that's going on. And and you're hearing the things that are affecting their quality of life. I'm hearing you're not interested in things. You have no motivation. That sense of joy and pleasure is gone. You're not sleeping well at night. You don't have an appetite. You're anxious. You're worried. You're feeling on edge. And it sounds like these things are really affecting your quality of life. And also it's also helpful to just talk about the things you're hearing in the conversation of how it's affecting them. I'm hearing you're not wanting to spend time with your family, like you used to. You're not doing the things you used to be able to do. And this is challenging. And I'm hearing and just recognizing this is really affecting how things are going. Usually, I think as well, the conversation with medication, I think, especially if people have never been on a medicine before, there can be just like you're alluded to a lot of stigma and feeling around what it means to be on a medicine like this. And so a lot of the conversation is around the idea of I basically trying to frame it in a sense of there's not like something wrong with you. Like this is not a defect or a failure of the person or anything like that. But the idea is I frame the medicine as a tool of something that may help some of the symptoms and help improve quality of life to some extent. But the way I usually also like to frame it is recognizing too that it's not going to get rid of all of the symptoms and all of the grief and all of the suffering of a person because they really are going through often a traumatic type of experience. And so recognizing as well that just to say like this may help to some extent, it's not going to get rid of all of this. And also the idea of, something like an anxiety or worrying in the setting of dealing with cancer isn't necessarily like maladaptive. If someone had cancer and wasn't worried about it at all, yeah, that would be much more concerning to me, right? The anxiety is just our brain telling us, hey, like this is something that we should be paying attention to. We just want to turn it down to a place where it's not interfering with our function, right? So that's kind of the idea is this is a tool. It may help and may improve your quality of life and improve some of these symptoms, but it's not going to resolve everything. And the idea too, of usually when I'm in the medicine, I'm framing it along with, again, that discussion that we had earlier about those other buckets of things. So I might say, you might notice you feel a little bit better, your mood's a bit better, you have a bit better energy. But the idea is once we feel that, we want to use that to then do a bit more things. So it's a conversation as well about those lifestyle, behavioral activation, other things we want to the medicine to help with. So as you start to feel better, like, let's work on what are some other goals we can set? Because the idea is the medicine, you know, has some effect, but often for really improving depression, we need to be doing other things besides. It's a lot to put on a pill once a day when you think about the huge amount of symptoms and the huge amount of effect of a cancer diagnosis on someone. So acknowledging this medicine may help a little bit, but we want to be adding on what else can we do to, as you're noticing that benefit, that we can include into your life. And whether that's, let's start walking again, let's spend some time outside, let's reconnect with family, let's, you know, whatever it might be, or let's, you know, let's connect you with a therapist, or let's connect you with physical therapy, or whatever that other thing is. And that way, I think also helps people to feel less stigmatized that, like, oh, like, take this pill. It's more like, no, like, let's work on all of these things that are bothering you. This is maybe a part of that, but I'm recognizing that we're going to need a lot more than just that. And because I'm hearing how affecting it is to you. And I think that can help the messaging as well, that one is normal, but also it's like that we're really thinking about it holistically.
You kind of take the cue from the patient too. I mean, you can sense what they're thinking about it, if they're hesitant, if they're all for it, if they're putting a lot of weight on it, if they really don't think it's going to work. And, you know, I don't think, especially for someone who's never taken an antidepressant before, you know, it's not unreasonable. Like, I find myself saying that this isn't a medicine that's going to change you fundamentally. I mean, that seems, but it's a thought that people will have. I don't want to be changed. I should be able to go through this, you know. And I say, you know, one thing I say that seems to work is I'll because you mentioned suffering, and I really like that. I use that where I say, you know, what an antidepressant does is it let, you know, that really kind of dire sort of feeling of suffering that you can have. It lessens it to an extent where you can then kind of move forward and start doing all those other things like you were talking about. Because you got to sort of set up the expectation for them. And I think it's also helpful. I mean, the majority of the depression treatment actually works. So it's fair to say, I really think this is going to help you. I also think it's fair to say this is a trial. It's the tool, like Boris mentioned, and that we're going to, you know, I don't want you to be on a medicine that you don't need to be on, but if it works for you, that's going to be a great thing for you. So we're going to try it. And then, yeah, so kind of going over like the parameters around, you know, like, you know, what, how long, how do you take it, in the morning or in the afternoon or in the evening, et cetera. So you go over all those things, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Well, that's certainly a definitely part of that psychoeducation, that discussion around the medicine. It will be the next step. Once you kind of just frame what the medicine does, it's then kind of logistics. Okay, this is when you'll take it. You know, this is how to increase it, because most of these we do want to titrate gradually. These are kind of the side effects to kind of just be aware of. And as far as the way I describe this, the vast majority of side effects related to most of these medications related to starting it. So most of the time, if you start at a very low dose, gradually increase it, most people don't experience that. So that's usually how I frame the side effects. And then also the expectation of how long the medicine takes, and recognizing that. And usually, again, the way I frame this is, as I say, that some people do notice a benefit right away. But I say, in general, we say 2 weeks for initial benefit and 4 to 6 weeks for the maximum benefit, because it is something that takes time to build up all the way. So giving them the expectation that. And because some people do notice an immediate effect, and whether that's is that a pharmacological effect, is that another effect? It's not, I don't know, we're not sure, but I leave the door open for that. But also I want to set an expectation that, you know, like technically we do say it's going to take some time to kick in. So to give them that kind of upfront. And also that I think sets the stage of that this is, you know, not something we can take as needed or just here and there. It really is something to be consistent with. And that's going back to the discussion around if people are feeling ready. I usually say that, like, gosh, like these medicines don't work right away. So if someone's very much feeling very unready to try it or is extremely hesitant, they're likely to experience some side effect that cause them to stop it very quickly. So usually the way I frame it is, and especially if often we make them a situation, if someone's tried one or two, they've had side effects, after a week, they stopped it. So I'll say, like, gosh, you know, you may have some side effects. We won't know if it's helping unless you stick with it. So unless you're feeling really ready to kind of put yourself out there and try it for that 4 to 6 weeks, it's okay. We don't have to do it yet. Sometimes putting the ball in their court like that can help them to feel more comfortable to take that step of making that trial and commitment to seeing how it might work for them.
Yeah, I like what you said about that. It's one of those things, especially when people are so anxious, you know, you start telling them about side effects and you know they're going to have it. I believe it's called nocebo that you sort of, it's the opposite of placebo. Just like you, not everyone gets these, but I'm going to tell you what they are. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, they're almost always self-limiting. So it's, you know, and I think that really helps because then people know what to expect if they have a little loose stool or diarrhea or like GI upset, nausea, the first week or two is their serotonin receptors kind of, you know, recalibrate themselves, you know, they can get through that. Like you'll hear a lot of these histories where people are like, oh, I tried this one, I tried that one, nothing really worked. And you ask them, well, how long did you take it for? Well, like a week or two, you know, and you're like, yeah, well, you're looking for that effect. And then you get it. And then, you know, we don't know. You just have to coach them on that. Like, if we did that well, we would see a lot of people really getting more of the benefit from these medications. You know, they're not panaceas necessarily, but they really, especially on an epidemiologic level, they do a lot of really good stuff for folks. So, okay, good. So we kind of like set that up. So I think we can go to, yes, treatment choices. So what you, we sort of set it out before, you know, knowing those four or five different drugs, and take it away. Like how, which ones, I think we need to use the, you know, the generic names, but you know.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, again, the four I usually kind of tell my learners about, and I would encourage them to kind of get comfortable with. And if you have a preference already, if there's a preference you have, oh, I really like to prescribe sertraline, I really like to prescribe fluoxetine. That's great. You don't have to learn new ones, but it is like, let's just get pick one from each class. The four that I think are the easiest, or at least the kind of initial ones that I might, you know, tell somebody about, from an SSRI standpoint, I typically suggest escitalopram. It has few drug interactions, as far as it affecting other drugs. Some drugs may affect it, but itself typically doesn't affect other drugs and tends to be among the most well-tolerated. So that's a very reasonable kind of SSRI. From an SNRI standpoint, duloxetine is a reasonable one because it has additional benefit for pain, and that's usually why we're reaching for an SNRI. And then mirtazapine is a good one to know about as well, because that has a very different side effect profile from those SSRIs, SNRIs. It tends to be sedating, it improves appetite, it does not have sexual side effects. So it has a very opposite sort of side effect profile. So it's good to have something that you just, and you can also use it as an adjuvant. You can use it combined with an SSRI or SNRI. And the last one would be bupropion. Again, the idea being that, again, has a very different side effect profile from all three of those, works a bit differently, and targets slightly different symptoms. It's a bit better for concentration, for focus, perhaps for energy. It has more of this, you know, activating sort of property as a perhaps a very, very mild stimulant, which is not shared among the other ones. So it'd be kind of the four that I typically kind of like, you know, encourage folks to kind of familiarize themselves with a bit. And even if it's just one, even if you just only know one, that's okay. At least, you know, we have one tool in toolbox. And then again, the sort of the algorithm we follow just boils down to, hey, what's the symptoms the person's having, and what's the side effects that we don't want? You know, it's kind of the basic stuff. This is kind of my, I'll just give a very simple algorithm. Step one is there a ton of anxiety? If there's a lot of anxiety present, we often may want something that has a bit more of that serotonergic component. That's usually either an SSRI or an SNRI. Now, the next part might be, are they having a ton of pain? If there's a ton of pain, maybe an SNRI may be helpful, especially neuropathic pain. Hot flashes, if that's going on, again, SSRI, SNRI, reasonable for that. Another consideration would be if they have a combination of both having insomnia and, you know, anorexia, or we want them to gain weight, in which case mirtazapine may be a really good option. Typically, I would think about mirtazapine is, do I want this person to sleep more and gain weight? And if so, this is maybe a fantastic choice because it doesn't have much drug interactions, And it does both of those things. However, if I don't want the person to gain weight, or the person does not want to gain weight, this is not a good choice because it very, very, very commonly leads to pretty significant weight gain for people. So, you know, that's kind of the kind of deciding one there. And last one is someone extremely concerned about sexual side effects? That's something they absolutely don't want. And are they having a lot of apathy, fatigue, concentration issues? In which case, bupropion would be kind of a good choice for that sort of symptom combination. So you've got those four. And then again, in general, the idea is because most of the side effects related to starting the medicine and the medicine itself doesn't work right away, my sense in general is favoring starting the medicine very conservatively, is increasing it slowly to minimize any side effects of starting, to get the person to be able to be on it. Because typically the symptoms are have been going on for a bit. If it takes an extra week or two or three to get them to start getting better, that's okay, because at least the patient is able to get on the medicine and stay on it, rather than if we start the dose too high and they have a side effect and they stop it and now they're hesitant and we're not really making progress. So I usually favor starting ultra low dose. And I'm actually curious around how you do yours, because I think this is kind of how I've kind of come to, but I'm curious how you do this too. But the usual kind of dosing I use here, so escitalopram, I typically started at what is considered an ultra low dose of 2.5 milligrams, much lower even than many people start. But by doing it that way, increasing it by 2.5 a week, most people tolerate it extremely well, and it itself being among the most well-tolerated SSRIs. So if somebody has a tolerability concern, that one's great. If you look at kind of systematic review meta-analyses that look at these kind of look at different combinations of medicines and the statistics, it's already well tolerated. So that's how I started. And I usually titrate all of them to kind of the initial therapeutic dose. That even the starting dose typically is not considered a therapeutic dose. So I want to start a low amount, gradually build it up to the initial therapeutic dose, and then see the person back and see how they're doing at that amount. So yeah, maybe starting 2.5, building up to 5 to 10. With Cymbalta, maybe starting at 20, maybe increasing it to 40 after a couple weeks. Bupropion, usually there's a lot of formulations, but I typically just prescribe the XL formulation, the once a day, just 150 in the morning. That's kind of a therapeutic dose already, so you can just see them back at that. Emirtazapine, I typically start at 7.5, and after a couple of weeks, you can increase to 15. Again, and with some of these, again, you could, you know, if a person is extremely elderly, extremely frail, you could, you know, just do something a bit even slower. But starting it extremely conservatively does, I think, help with getting a person to feel comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And once they're on it, it's much easier to make further changes, and they might notice the benefits.
No, that's great. I agree. You're kind of balancing convenience and, you know, efficacy, and tolerability, and all of that. And I tend to favor the medicines where the starting dose and the target dose are pretty similar. You know, it's just easier that way. And so, actually, escitalopram is one where if you're at 10 milligrams, you're at the target dose. It's also, you know, it's reasonable to start at 10 milligrams if you want to start at 10 milligrams, and then you have them. You say, you know, all of these except for a couple, you start in the morning because the serotonergic activity is kind of what we talk about. It's activating, and I would describe it like, well, it's kind of like coffee. You know, like it just gives you a little bit of oomph. Some people like that. Some people don't like that feeling. But you need to kind of expect it, especially when you're starting out. But I think the other thing is some are tablets and some are capsules. Mm-hmm. So if I were starting, let's say, sertraline, I might start a 50 milligram. That's the starting dose is 50 milligrams. But I might say, just, you know, break the tablet in half for the first week as you get used to it, and then go on at 50. But I think it also depends on how anxious they are. And the more anxious, the lower the dose, and then the slower I tend to go, because they have to, and I actually go over, you know, you're anxious, and I talk about body scanning and like symptoms and paying attention to them, and sort of saying, well, you don't necessarily have to pay, you know, anything that's going to be concerning, you're going to know it's going to come back again and again. And so I kind of give them permission to like not do the body scanning all the time. It's because that first period of time when you're starting an antidepressant is a little tricky. And it's also why, you know, it's not uncommon to start a benzodiazepine at the same time, you know, and you just limited kind of amount. But if they're nauseous, they can use it for that. You know, we didn't mention it all at once, but I think it's helpful to say major side effects, things that you want to talk about right when you're starting, the GI side effects, the activation part of it. Okay. You might just feel a little edgy. And that tends to go away unless it's a really activating one. Of the ones that we mentioned, only bupropion fits that category. And then the third thing that's crucial is sexual side effects. Mm-hmm. So you just have to mention it, and you tell them it's delayed orgasm, and it can be libido. I just say it. And it actually is a really nice thing, because it sort of opens that conversation up. So those are the three main ones, the side effect wise.
Absolutely.
And then you said sort of targeting those symptoms, like bupropion, we use for smoking cessation. Obviously, we use off-label for helping with concentration and like ADHD type symptoms. And so I do pretty much the same things that you just described in terms of like dose titration and stuff. You just want to make sure, and actually, if you look in up to date, I hope I can say up to date, you know, it's right there. It tells you exactly what the initial dose should be and where the target dose is as a range. I want to share, because we're running a little low on time, I want to share just one anecdotal thing, because one of the things that Boris and I both know is that the titration of these medicines is key. And so I had a patient that she had a history of depressive symptoms. And it turned out that like her father had been an old timey kind of GP doc. And she used to get these phone calls at her house. And for her whole life, she was afraid of the phone, because many of these phone calls she had as a child, you know, in a practice like that, were kind of traumatic. And she had been on fluoxetine, 20 milligrams, as Boris knows, that's the starting dose, you know. And I remember I said, well, I met her the first time. I said, well, let's go up to 40 milligrams. And lo and behold, she came in the next time and she said, I am answering the phone for the first time in my life. She's like, I've lived my whole life never answering the phone. I didn't really understand what that meant, but as she explained it to me, she said, this dose increase made such a huge difference in her life. And it was just a matter of getting it to that target dose. So anyway, I just share that because it's kind of a wild story, and speaks to that issue. Anything else we want to kind of touch on? I think we've hit a lot of the main components of just getting started and thinking about depression treatment and getting started on a medication. I like what you said, getting to know a few of them really well, the doses, and we talked a lot about how you start it, how you talk about it with patients, where the pitfalls are. Anything else you can think of, Boris?
A lot of these things are online, and it's okay to look it up. It's okay to triple check. Once you do it a couple of times, you'll get so much more comfortable. And again, I think that's one of the very satisfying things that can happen is these things can be life-changing for people. And I think that's the interesting thing in oncology and working in psycho-oncology is a lot of times the symptoms people are having may not be new just with the cancer. These are maybe things people have been dealing with for a very long time. And just the cancer tipped things over the edge. And now they're finally ready to talk about it. And now we start something and we start a treatment. And they're like, wow, this is, I felt, and I've had patients that are like, I felt the best that I've ever felt. And then like, I've dealt with cancer, but I don't deal with this anxiety anymore. And so it can be quite satisfying to try something that has this really impressive effect on someone. And so, and I think that's sort of like, you know, certainly not everybody has this amazing effect, but many people do. And it can be quite life-changing for people and improve their relationships. And maybe that's our last thing as far as just an earlier question around time's disorder, right? So if you're noticing that someone is having difficulty with the treatment, they're thinking about stopping treatment because of anxiety, because of depression, those would be other times to really, I really want to make sure I'm including a treatment for this because now it is really affecting their cancer outcomes and treatment. And then maybe the last thing I just want to mention really fast is real quick side effects on it, just to kind of just put those out there. And all related to the initial step. I love what you mentioned about sexual side effects. Those are definitely ones to mention because that opens the door for patients to mention it, because a lot of times they will not mention it unless they are asked or unless brought up. The last other one, just really quick point I will say for the serotonergic antidepressants in particular, they can have some hyponatremia in elderly patients. These are extremely well-tolerated, extremely safe medicine with practically minimal risk. That is the one thing though, if you have an elderly person that you're starting it, I would check the sodium. That would be like the one. Otherwise, there's no monitoring. These are very safe medicines, which are often, you know, can be quite helpful. And again, comparing that to the extremely complicated, you know, super involved monitoring, you know, treatments we have in oncology, these are really quite simple, and can make a huge difference for people. So, yeah.
The one other thing I'd say is a common question is how long will it take? We generally say, well, if you think about the course of a depressive episode being about, you know, 9 months or something, I always learn 9 months, but so I always tell patients to think of it taking it for a year. And then I say, you know, when that year comes up, right, we might talk about it, and they say, well, should I come off it or not? And then the conversation is about, well, it kind of depends why you started it. You know, was it something more situational? How many times have you gone through depression? Was there really a big risk? And that kind of thing. But when you're starting it, just to say a year, I think is it's fair, because people in their minds, they're kind of thinking, am I going to be on this for the rest of my life? You know, so that's, they might not vocalize that, but it is, I'm sure it's a thought. Well, it's been a real pleasure, Boris. Thank you so much for meeting with me again. And I think this is going to really help our oncologist friends out there to treat their patients. And so thank you again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's always fantastic to just talk and connect. And hopefully this will be helpful for some folks.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at Cancer Network and find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook at cancernetwork.co or on LinkedIn at cancernetwork.com.